So welcome. This is a routing working group session for this RIPE this afternoon here in Dubai. We are a little bit time constrained, so sorry for already being a couple minutes late. The agenda is pretty full. There's the first items. I don't know if anyone would have anything to add. We will be adding one item, in fact, probably after item B, concerning some work that has popped up. So this is the agenda. Just so you have an overview, it will definitely take us through the whole slot. If you have minor items, you can always add them at the, any other business part. The RIPE-NCC is providing both a minute taker and a JavaScript, for which we thank. Regarding the minutes of the last meeting, they were circulated some time ago. We haven't seen any comments. Unless someone has comments right now, I'll proceed to declare them final. Okay, they are now final. Present here today, as we have the full set of routing working group chairs for a long time. Rob Evans, who is over there and does a great job. And Joachim Smit, who a lot of you may know is and has joined us after a long absence, and most welcome. My name, by the way, is Joel Amos. So we'll go straight into the agenda. Where is Shane? Okay.
Hello. So my name is Shane Kerr, and I'm going to be talking about the IRR toolset software community. So, but I'm not going to start with that. I'm going to talk about Lawrence Lessing. I don't know if any of you know him, but he does copyright stuff. He does Creative Commons these days. And if you've ever seen him talk, it's fantastic. There's a picture of him there. So the thing about him is that his presentations are actually quite interesting, and it doesn't really matter what he's talking about. You just kind of like to hear him talk. So I realize I'm going to be here after lunch, and many of you might be a little bit sleepy. And this is, but I want you all to be active and involved and interested in what's going on, because it's the IR toolset. And every time the IR toolset comes up, there's always a lot of people who express interest in it, and it is apparently a useful tool. But there's been a long history of problems with it, and I'll go into that in a bit, mostly in terms of getting support and people who will actually work on it. So, but what is it? The IRR toolset is a set of tools, it says here, a set of tools to work with internet routing policies. So there are routing registries which contain information about routes, and these are stored in the routing policy specification language. And basically it's a vendor-neutral way to put information about what you're advertising and what you'll accept on your routers. And so the IR toolset is a set of tools that you use to take this information and you can do useful things with it. The canonical example of this is you can actually build router configs or portions of your router configs based on what people have published about their AS numbers and things like that. This is the site where you can go to now to look at the tools, and there's documentation and all kinds of good stuff. So I'm going to go back into history, and we're going to talk about where the IR toolset comes from and then why I'm presenting today. So it's actually quite an old set of tools, and it was originally developed as part of the Routing Arbiter toolset. And this was from an earlier time when there were some ideas, different ideas about how we would address scalability and routing on the internet and things like that. But because the IR toolset was useful, it stayed around long after the rest of the work in this area died. It was called the RA toolset because it was part of the Routing Arbiter project, but then it was taken over by the RIPE-NCC because there was not really any resources being put into maintaining it. And I think it was Joao, is that correct? Was this you? Yeah. Joao thought, well, this is something that's useful to the community. It's been kind of abandoned, so RIPE-NCC has some resources that'll take it on. But what happened over time was, I was at the RIPE NCC at this time, and my group was the group that kind of maintained this stuff. And we realized that the RIPE NCC isn't actually a software development company. It does a lot of software development in the context of the other work that it's doing. So we looked around and tried to find some people who are software development companies, and that's how it came to be at ISC. ISC, they write Bind, they write DHCP server, and they do a lot of networking stuff as well, but a large part of their work is actively developing software. So it made sense to transfer the IR toolset one more time from the RIPE NCC to ISC. So the status in mid-2008, a few months ago, was that ISC was maintaining this code. And ISC has a fairly well-developed software engineering process. I was at ISC at this time, well, slightly before this time. And part of that process is all software changes are reviewed by other software engineers. There's standards for documentation. There's tickets that you can go through and review why changes are made and all this stuff. And it's there for a reason. It's there to maintain the high quality of the ISC code. It works pretty good. But it's not a free process. It does mean that it's heavier weight. So no one from outside of ISC could commit to the source tree or anything like that. And patches had, time had to be taken away from other projects within ISC to actually apply these patches to the IR tool set. So you can kind of look at it. There's a famous book called The Cathedral and the Bazaar. The whole idea is the cathedral is a more centralized way of maintaining software, and the bazaar is more community-driven. So at that time, the IR tool set was very, very definitely in the cathedral model. There's kind of, this is the place you go to when you ask for changes or when you want to do things. And what ended up happening was a lot of the patches took a long time to get applied. Simple things got sent to the mailing list and were discussed, but there weren't any resources at ISC to do it because it didn't really match well to the model. So that's where we were a few months ago. So one of the biggest users of this software is the RIPE NCC. So they decided that they wanted to try to increase the turnaround time, I guess you could say, try to revive the interest in the IR tool set. Because there were people who said, this is very useful to us. We're interested in this. We use it every day. We want changes to happen. And so the RIPE NCC decided, well, what can we do to do this? So they approached ISC, and they said, well, we'd like to actually move this into a more public community of development, the IR toolset software community. So everyone agreed, moved forward. And so now where are we today? Well, we're here. And here's the current status. What happened was they agreed on setting up a Track site. Track is mostly a online web software development framework. And that sounds really weird, but what it really means is there's a wiki, which we all know and love wikis. There's also a way for it to integrate with the Subversion source tree. There's a way to set, to do ticket tracking as well. So it's basically just kind of, you get your error reporting and your feature requests and your release status and all your documentation all combined into one area. And that's up and running right now. And that's the URL that I showed you earlier, and I'll show you again. The source code has been converted. Originally, the source code for this project was something called PRCS or something like that. It was then converted into CVS, and now it's been converted into Subversion. And hopefully it'll stay there for another decade or so, and then it'll get converted to the latest thing. Not all, but most of the patches that I could find on the mailing list have been merged into the source tree. There's a few outstanding ones, but right now everything's tracked in tickets, so nothing should be forgotten. And there's one more work action that's on my plate right now, which is to kind of wrap up all the patches that have been integrated and all the changes that have been made, and make one final release under the ISC banner, which is not a community release. So, and in theory, the community is interested in this stuff. And that's what remains to be seen. When the site was up and running, I sent a message to the IR toolset mailing list. There was a lot of interest, and it really kind of revived at that time. So there are people who are interested in this stuff. The main issue is that it's no one's day job. No one gets paid to make changes to this software. People have forked and are running their own code, which I'm hoping was just a symptom of the difficulty that it was to get changes merged in earlier. So this is the URL where you can go to and take a look at the documentation. It's not just for developers. It also tells you how to install it. It has documentation about how to use it. There's links to tutorials that have been given and everything. The site is also completely open right now. If you want to change it, go ahead and click on edit. It's like the Wikipedia. There's no restrictions. The source code repository does have restrictions. If you want to make changes and commit them yourself, please let me know, or send a mail to the mailing list, also possible, and we'll get your authentication added. The community right now, as I see it, is the mailing list. Anyone is free to participate. If people in the community decide they want a more organized structure or they want it more closed, then that's completely up to the people involved. For my own personal involvement, I intend to remain involved in a capacity of kind of facilitating things. I'm definitely not in charge of this effort. It's hosted still by ISC, and I actually haven't made any useful changes to the code for a long time. It's all been herding in other people's additions and fixes and things like that. So if it is to be a community, it needs the help from the people who are using it or people who have time and interest. So this is me begging you to participate and make this an actual community development project and kind of keep it alive. That's it.
I'll find it later. Okay, does anyone have any comments or questions regarding this project? No? In that case, I thought you were going to about your operations business.
Go ahead. Here, right, and see. So, when will it support ASN32?
I think this is a nice example of what Shane was just talking about.
That's a fine question. So the question was about 4-byte ASNs, right?
Yeah.
32 bits, yeah. So there are patches out there, and I deliberately chose not to merge them as a kind of test case for this. I don't remember who wrote them. There's a ticket on the website listing this as an action item. I'd be very happy if anyone would volunteer to do the work of merging that in.
I didn't intend to comment on that, but as far as I know, there are several proposals for patches. Of course, if the RPSL protocol is changed regarding the representation of the AS numbers, that has some influence. And in fact, a little bit of thinking and definition has to go into what actually support means. For me, it was a fairly late surprise to figure out that, actually you need two different modes, whether you are generating code for an old, only 16-bit system or a new one. Having the site up now is very much appreciated. One question I'm seeing is, Shane, you were saying, the ISC procedures are there to protect the high quality of the ISC code. Unfortunately, the IR toolset didn't come in with the ISC quality of software, and that made things even harder. And one of the really nasty things is that, in fact, there is no real documentation of the internal workings of the toolset available, while the toolset makes heavy use of object-oriented concepts and data and hiding. So one of the questions is there any perspective of, how we could get a little bit of documentation out there?
Okay.
Things like what you just mentioned were never in the to-do list as far as ISC was concerned, much less from now on. ISC, I mean, this whole transition, by the way, I should say, was possible thanks to the RIBE NCC, who decided to fund the activity, okay? As part of the deal, ISC also committed to having periodic time, engineering time, dedicated to wrap up all the community contributions into releases. But the work from now on is up to the community. The code was not the best code I've ever seen to begin with. No one I've ever seen has found it enjoyable to work with this code. The people who do, it's because they need it, because they use it. It's from now on, basically, we will support this, keep the site running, keep the repositories accessible, produce the releases when there are patches, but it definitely is up to the community to come up with the things. If there are, for instance, if there are several 32-bit ISN support patches produced out there, it is up to the community to decide which one they want to pick, which one is the one that fulfills their needs, and agree on it. And once there is one final, then we'll go around, round it up, and produce the next release.
Yeah, and I'm sorry about the problems getting a 32-bit filter. I actually wasn't aware of that. And what I've tried to do is, if I see something on the mailing list, I try to just kind of copy the information and put it on the website. And there's no reason it has to be me that does that. So, of course, the web. Is it a mailman? I don't know. But there's a way to search the mailing list. But of course, having it in a pre-digested way and not having to figure out which of the 4,000 messages you're looking at is the one that actually solves your problem is quite handy. So, anyway.
Okay. So we'll skip to the...
Oops. Maybe just one last comment.
Of course.
Well, RIBE NCC sponsored somehow this effort, and I would say I'm very pleased with what I see. I think it's a very good step forward. And hopefully, even with this old and a lot of legacy stuff in the code, it will still... slightly revive this project and let it live for another few years.
That's my hope as well. Thank you. I'm going to, as I mentioned earlier, introduce a new point in the agenda here, hopefully it's a short one. At the previous REC meeting, a policy proposal was put forward to have the RIBE NCC study, in conjunction with the RIBE community, the use of RPKI certificates for the authentication of RPSL objects. When this was discussed, I think it was discussed in the plenary, I think most of the people, at least, I think everyone actually, thought that the RIBE PDP was not the right way of going about this thing, and that it should be dealt with in a separate venue, namely the routing working group. One of the proposals being Randy, that old fox, he decided he wouldn't withdraw the policy proposal until we actually did something in the other venue we were talking about. So we have this. I'm with you. I think you are a wise man. So we are going to do something about it. We have been talking around to how we are going to deal with this. This is the sort of harder than average subject to go about. And so therefore, we thought that it would be good to have a small focus group to come up with the original plan. I know there is already work going on to deal with this. BBN has done some stuff. The RIBE NCC has also done some work. So the proposal I put to you right now here is that we, as we have done in other occasions up here at the RIBE, that we form a task force chartered to look at this issue and come back to here in two meetings, three meetings at most, with a report on what it is that the Red NCC should be doing to fulfill the expressed need. Of course, we would need the participation of the Red NCC in this. And to address that in that way, and hopefully be able to clear the process that's pending in the PDP, which doesn't really belong there. I have been trying to go around the corridors, fishing people for this. I had most success with Rudiger, so I'll name him the first member. I'll definitely want people from Ripe NCC to have someone designated to participate and help out with the evaluation of what needs done, basically because eventually, as the outcome of all Ripe task forces ends up being actions on Ripe NCC, so they better be aware. And anyone else who has shown an interest on the and understanding of both RPSL and RPKI could come forward and participate in this effort. And I am volunteering myself into that thing for whatever I still remember of RPSL. And others are welcome. So this is an open call.
Well, okay. As I have been volunteered already, well, okay, I'm not really answering your question. Mm-hmm. Additional volunteers are welcome, but... Okay. The status that I'm seeing currently is that there are essentially two implementation options, which are kind of addressing different modes. The implementation option that needs to be done for support via the RIPE database server has been drafted quite nicely by André already. And at the Dublin IETF, there was at least one slide showing kind of the supposed output of that. I'm guilty of sitting on drafts too long for and not passing them on. So I guess that's going to happen quite quickly. And I also have to report that the other option for implementation, which is better for people who want to do the validation of the data themselves, is being attacked by BBN, and I have seen very good output from test runs there. So it looks like essentially the things are very close to completion on that track. And again, I think there are not too many open issues on the RIPE track.
So much the better, Randy.
Randy Bush, IIJ. I think the real question is they're starting to be running code, and how do we protect actual work from study groups and other things like that? I have two lives, one I'm an operator, one I'm a researcher, and I just want to warn you that I am studying to see how much bureaucratic process we can wrap around about 500 lines of code.
An infinite amount. André.
Andrei Rwaczewski, RIPE NCC. Well, I have some experience in actually trying to make some progress with this proposal. And at the beginning, it looked like a quick hack that can deliver low-hanging fruit to us. But once we started looking at the details, and that's really the devil is in the details, things got a bit complicated. And we were facing some trade-offs that, well, decisions have to be made. So that, I think now we have two options. Either we really go to a quick hack and call it a hack and accept the limitations, but really go for a very, very simple solution, not trying to solve all the problems of the world. Or we indeed look at the wider picture, because what is really we're trying to solve here? Is it we're trying just to represent raw in RPSL, or are we trying to improve security of the Internet Routing Registry? We all know that current mechanisms of securing routing registry are pretty outdated. They're very cumbersome, they somehow not always achieve the goal, and they can't solve all the use cases. They actually can only solve a fraction of the use cases that people have. Now, is the question, can we use RPKI as a leverage to solve some of those problems? If this is that question, then I would say, well, the proposal that Curtis and Randy put forward is not the only way to solve those problems. So just to summarize, I think there are two ways. Either we go for quick hacks, we call them quick hacks, we do this quickly and probably dirty, or we form task forces and look at the bigger picture.
Okay. The understanding, to me at least, from what I've heard from the several people, is that there is not even an agreement on whether the quick hack is the way to go or the other way. The more structured approach is the way to go. And hence, I would like at least to document this. The task force suggestion I put forward here, I did, because the task force mechanism at RIPE is a very lightweight thing, and all it does is ensure that the RIPE NCC does dedicate resources to this, and that the few people who are named assume responsibilities for actually doing work.
Just to be clear, Curtis and I were asking for the quick hack. The correct solution, we know, and it has nothing to do with this. It's the real RPKI, origin checking, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That's coming. Don't spend a lot of effort on this.
It's not the intention. It's to ensure that it runs to completion quickly.
Yeah. Well, okay. Again, Rudiger, my intention was this should be a quick hack, and I disagree slightly with Randy because, well, okay, actually the quick hack provides some very early incentive for populating the RPKI, which will help to actually speed up the real solutions if they come in quickly. Mm-hmm.
I'm just acting as a facilitator. If you believe that you can get together, the three of you, and put something together, and at the same time withdraw that other thing that's got stuck in the PDP, I'm more than willing to take that solution. If it turns out that things don't work the way you expect, we can always revisit this. It's entirely up to you. This is about facilitation, not about overcharging.
Just a comment from the Jabber room. Jeff Houston has volunteered to participate.
Okay, well, kind of expected. Thanks.
Just for the record, Andrei Robachevsky, RIPE NCC, I'm volunteering to participate in the task force.
Okay. So I'll round you up. I'll ask you about your commitments, and we'll see if this will be enough or we actually need to form a task force to ensure that there is a bit more structure and things actually get done. Thank you. Okay, so we resume the previously announced program. Dave, if you could come up.
There are two. Which one of the two is the one? Is that today?
No, mail. I'll clean off thing on desktop.
Thank you very much. My name is Dave Wilson. With my RIPE hat on, I'm a member of the address supporting organization, Address Council, elected by your good selves. And in my day job, if you like, I work for the National Research Network in Ireland in the Network Development Group. One of the things that I did about 2 months ago, I decided I want to get some experience with using a 4-byte AS number as if it were a client of ours and see what happens. I was pretty confident now that it would work, that the session would come up with our routers that would be able to exchange routes and exchange traffic. I was more interested in what would happen further out in the internet and if I was able to see that and analyze that. Now, I'm still working on this. There's only been a month or so of actual measurement taking place here, if that. But one of the things that happened that occurred caused a bit of a shock for my knock, and I think it might be a bit of a surprise to yourselves as well, and I want to mention it. So, as I say, I was fairly sure local operation would work. I was fairly sure that the backward compatible part, where the 32-bit AS number is transformed into AS23456, and then back again at the other end using some BGP attributes, would all hang together. I was wondering if we'd see that further out in the internet. So, what I did, I thought, need to do something fairly quickly because the 1st of January 2009 is almost upon us and there's only one bright meeting between then and now. So I put together the shonkiest of test plans, which was get a 32-bit AS number, get some PI space on a time-limited basis from the RIPE NCC, announce it, stick a machine in that space, found an old desktop machine, put it under my desk and installed Smokehang on it, and see what happens that hopefully doesn't make or lose anyone any money. So that space was assigned, and I went through a short process of notifying our peers that this session or this prefix was going to appear with this strange AS number. Don't panic, it'll all be fine. Those reassurances were slightly misplaced. And then updated the right database and scheduled the routing change. So first thing I did, of course, being a good internet citizen, was put the new route object and an update to our AS set in the right database. Had to add a new member, of course. This happened a couple of days before I planned to bring up the announcement of the route on our existing sessions. And I got a bit of a shock the next morning when I came in. One of our BGP sessions, a couple of BGP sessions, had gone down. No, I lied to you. The session was up. We were receiving all routes from it. We were sending traffic to it, and the traffic was being dropped. Why did this happen? Well, like I said, I added AS3.15, which is the AS we were assigned, to our AS set. This is a perfectly syntactically valid change. It was accepted by the RIPE database. The next morning, our peers generated the route filters. And on at least one of those peers, the use of IRR toolset in this case, I'm not saying current installations, but their own installation that they were working on that day, which is only about a month or so ago, broke, and it fed into a script which broke in an unpredictable way. Never expected this to happen. You don't necessarily expect that software to break on valid input from that database. And, okay, so the routing filters broke. They lost most of our prefixes in the routing filters, which is fine. It means you get rerouting via transit or something nasty like that, but the traffic still flows, except it didn't, because our peer in this case, in fact, you could call them an upstream because they have so many prefixes sent to us. It's a JNOT in this case. Apply strict URPF. And so we were sending them lots of traffic, highly local preferenced, toward pretty much all the academic institutions in Europe, going out this 10 gig link. And the traffic was dropped because all the sources were not recognized as being legitimately advertised by us. So that's about a 4.5 hour outage on our, not just on our link, but on all sites that would be connected via that link. So that's the shock my knock got. What did we have to do? Well, of course, out came the member of the set. I did create, and this is probably breaking the rules now at this point, I created two root objects for the prefix because they were both, in theory, legitimately rooted via, legitimately originated by one AS or the other. They're still in the database. So the same day, and I don't know how my knock let me away with this, but they let me away with this, I started announcing the prefix. I originated that first from our own AS number to get a baseline, if you like, set up my smoke ping box, thought, what's a good set of fairly reliable devices that one can ping and get results back on from that are scattered around the world? The right TTM boxes, of course. Did exactly that. Then 5 days later, withdrew the original announcement, advertised it again, this time originated from 3.15, transiting our own 32 AS, and the world did not end. There was a short outage while the announcement was withdrawn and then re-advertised, and connectivity was restored. With a few differences, we did see some effects. The next problem I had was I could look at all this data. It was very pretty. There were some changes, but it was very hard to correlate that with any kind of change to routing. It was probably the case, and it is probably the case, that when we restore a prefix and announce it, even sourcing from a different AS, all that's really changed is the order in which any given AS has received that announcement, and therefore the routing decision that they make will be based on that. I can't see their decision because I couldn't get trace routes back. The only interesting traffic here, being that I'm concerned about announcements, is traffic back toward us. I didn't have that information from random smoke pings, so I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could take our test traffic box and put it behind this AS number? So the guys at Ripe, with me sending them very pushy and very difficult emails, were very good, very kind, and renumbered that box in fairly short order. We managed to get it up and working on the new LAN. I don't have anything that shows anything is broken here. It looks to me like if you do route the traffic, once you get the announcement sent, once you get it out on the internet and get traffic coming back, there's no big change. There have been some changes, but so far I have nothing I can see that really shows a difference between that really highlights the 32-bit AS number as being a problem. I think if you withdraw the announcement and then send the same announcement, you will get the same small instabilities that you see in this case. We want to prove this. So the next steps that I plan to do here, working with someone else on this, I'm going to start flipping a coin. In fact, I'm due to flip a coin right now and then originate the prefix based on that about once a week, either from 12.13 or from 3.15. We'll do this for a few weeks. Then I'm going to leave smoke ping running to try and identify the funnies just so I can see where the changes are in a handy format, and then start using the other tools that are there, TTM and RISC, both excellent tools for this, to try and identify them. And what I'm really on the lookout for here are effects that I can reliably repeat but change depending on the origin, not depending on anything else. That's why it's flipping the coin rather than just swapping it once a week. So the big lessons here, and the reason why I asked for a bit of time in the working group, is AS dot appearing in the Ripe database was a non-backward compatible change, which is fine. Okay, I'm not going to sit here and complain about that. But AS plain itself is disallowed in the Ripe database. Now, that's probably wise. Otherwise, we'd have to have an extra mode in interpretation. What I want to raise here is we don't use IRR toolset in HEANF. We never have. And our peers don't have any 32-bit ASNs, and yet this bit, both of us, a bit more than one peer, by the way, but Jayant were, or Dante, I should say, were kind enough to let me discuss the results in public. Even though we never used IRR toolset, and even though we have no control over the updates that our peers may make to the software, we can still be bitten by software that's been deployed and hasn't been updated recently. Patches are available now, I must emphasize. And in fact, I've been gazumped on this one because it's already been discussed. But if you do want to find the current patches for IRR or toolset for 32-bit ASNs in AS.format, that's where to find them. Henk kindly provided me with the information here. Obviously, there are several proposals out there now suggesting to use AS plain format. And I understand that the document that suggests this is now on last call at the IATF is expected to be approved sometime in the next month or so, or has that moved on since? And obviously this means anyone who is currently using code, including, I guess, patched versions of IRR toolset, to either parse or print that format, will have to replace that code. And that's what I discovered. I hope we don't mind that I took a little time to mention the big surprise we had, and I'll be happy to hand back to the chairs. Thank you very much.
So rather than, okay, Gerd.
Gerd Düring, owner of 3.3, and well, being nasty to my neighbors as well. Well, thanks for the experiment and for the feedback. We did it in a sort of less well organized way. We just announced one of our /24s. With origin 3.3, put it all in the Ripe database, and I got an angry call from Rüdiger that all his scripts broke, which was sort of the goal, to not to annoy Rüdiger, of course, but to to sort of have an early warning of what's going to explode. Our upstream filters didn't properly pick up the prefix, and well, peering had interesting issues. It has been mentioned that AS.dot is a stupid idea because it's incompatible, but I actually still think it was a good idea because it is incompatible, because you know that you have to do something, and you will not be surprised when a 16-bit counter overruns and your data type is just 16-bit, and you will just not notice. But anyway, that train seems to have gone off. Thanks for the experiment.
Really gone. Just a few remarks on, well, okay, seeing the thing kind of from the other side. We are generating filters based on IRR toolset. Luckily, we had already done some improvements on IRR toolset, so we didn't fall into the trap that your upstream had, that, well, okay, the standard IRR toolset, if it runs into any problem, it just continues and doesn't set exit status or anything. So if you have incorporated that software into some larger scripts and you rely that it works always well, you may have very unpleasant surprises. I had the unpleasant surprise that, well, okay, our production run ran into an abnormal end and said, well, okay, with Gert's announcements, there are some problems. When I fixed that with some manual workaround, unfortunately, it turned out the same problem was also seen for three other peers because they were also alternate upstreams. Well, okay, the important lesson there is that, well, okay, it's very important that the software that is used in production actually reports errors. And if we haven't got IR toolset fixed in that regard, in the public version, we need to. The other thing is, well, okay, 2 years ago at the RIPE meeting, there was the discussion about the incompatible extension of our RPSL. And I know I stood up and said, well, okay, I would like to see a plan that, well, okay, has an appropriate time frame for, well, okay, addressing the clients. That didn't happen, and while okay, having seen the whole thing, I think that in the future, incompatible changes, which will be required, will have to be addressed in a way so that actually existing clients do not get impacted, and there are ways to do it.
Thank you, Rüdiger.
If I may, if there's time, I have one comment on the first point you make. You're right, of course. I do want to point out that one thing we did observe, without naming names, was that this wasn't simply a matter of someone running IRR toolset and having it in a quant job, which generated some filters which are uploaded directly to the router. These fed into scripts. Those scripts themselves, which are probably not a part of the IRR toolset distribution, failed. No one but the individual has control over those, and I, as their peer, don't have control over those. And in some cases, there was human intervention, which itself was fallible. And the worst still happened. So even those weren't good enough to save us.
Very quickly, Lorenzo.
Just curious, Lorenzo, why didn't you announce two prefixes, one from 12.13 and one from 3.15, instead of flipping the coin?
Oh, I see what you mean. Good point. I didn't ask for two prefixes. We do announce lots of prefixes from 12.13, so one could make the comparison there. I think I'll do that, actually. But my fear there is that the other prefixes will probably be treated in a different way anyway, because they're subject to different instabilities, and because they've been on the internet for a long time already.
Hank, quickly, please.
Hank Uitenhout. On the RPSL point, about 2 years ago, Katie and I wrote an internet draft on what had to be changed in your RPSL codes when going to ASN32. That we were told to hold that draft until the formatting discussion finished. Now that it has, well, we can revive it, though I think it will be much shorter than the first iteration.
Okay, thanks. The internet graph on textual representation of AS numbers, I think, is well past. I mean, it's like it's just a matter of time that it shows up as a proper RFC, I think, if it's not already. So I only have one quick question for the RIPE-NCC left, which is if AS plane is disallowed currently, but it is the new chosen format, would you incorporate that fairly quickly, perhaps? The change in the RIPE database software to allow AS plane?
I think we want our software to comply with the IETF standard. So the answer is yes. Well, the thing is slightly more complicated. I think it will be discussed tomorrow in the database working group, is that when we implement as dot, right, there was a clear flag date. Right, there was no 32-bit AS numbers, and all of a sudden we start allocating. Now there is no flag date per se, right, because 1st of January is not really a flag date, right? It's slightly changing the policy, not in the state of the S numbers. So more coordination will be required with other RIS and IAN as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
The next one up is Clarence.
Okay. Good afternoon. This is content that I have prepared with Pierre-François. So the objective of this talk is to give you, to show you what are the low-hanging fruits with the IPFRR technology, and then to equip you with the questions that you should ask yourself before attempting to use what I would say are the very high-hanging fruits, because they might imply a lot of complexity for a marginal gain. So the plan of the talk, in order to give you this analysis, is the following. We're going to describe what is the principle of simplicity, a few terminology, and then look at requirement for routing conversions, because it's often here that you will find a source of unneeded complexity. Then a quick review of the IGP convergence status, because it's the foundation for everything. It's always needed, so we'll quickly look at this, and then we'll see what are the low-hanging fruits and the questions to ask to assess the other fruits on the IPFRR tree, and then we will conclude. So the principle of simplicity, I could describe it in three ways. Either a quote, we're talking about IGP technology, so a quote from Dijkstra is interesting. He said, simplicity is prerequisite for reliability. So if you look at some of the IPFRR components, the complexity is quite important, and so it's quite obvious that you'll have an impact on reliability there. Another way to look at it is from a picture, and you have a Japanese garden. It's very simple, but still, for many people, very beautiful. And then the curve that I like a lot through the projects that I try to do either internally or with customers is actually to plot the gains versus the costs. Because too often people talk about, for example, 50 milliseconds like on Monday, but only on the vertical axis. They don't look at what are the cost or complexity that are involved by these decisions. And I think the principle of simplicity, or the KISS principle, is to find a knee in the curve where you maximize the gain while you minimize the cost. And although an academic optimum, as I would call it, exists where you can have maybe all of the gains that you could dream of, or 50 milliseconds in all the cases you could think of, the cost it incurs to you and your design and deployment is huge compared to the marginal benefit. And so it's very important to consider the two dimensions of this trade-off decision. In terms of terminology, very quickly, we're going to talk about IGP convergence upon managed or unmanaged link or node failures. We take any link or node failures within the network or at the edge, except the peering links, because that's a BGP problem. And the simple solution to this is the BGP prefix independent convergence that was presented at NANOC 6 months ago. We're going to talk about IPFRR. IPFRR is about local protection, which means that you pre-compute in advance of the failure a backup path that you pre-install into the data plane, into the hardware. And then you detect the failure locally, and you use your pre-computed backup path, and the property of this backup path is that they do not require any awareness of your neighbors about the failure. They're going to participate to the backup path, but without knowing that a link failed, and that's a key property of a local protection technique. We're going to talk about microloops. So what is a microloop? It's a natural property of an IGP protocol. It has been like this since the beginning. It's a natural property. When you have an event into the topology, the IGP converge, and as the different routers converge, they actually do not converge exactly at the same time, obviously. And depending on the timing of events, they might have transient inconsistent tables where they point at each other and they create a transient loops. These are occurring while the network is converging. So because they are transient, we call them microloops. And so part of the IPFR technology or research project has been to see, can we avoid microloops? And so we look at what are the gains and costs of these techniques. This slide is about requirement. Extremely important to define carefully what is really your requirement. There's a big difference between the perceived requirement and the real requirement. And unfortunately, once you define your requirement, it really often defines how much complex your design and deployment will be. So my personal view is that if you look at routing outages, human beings actually do not bother if the outage is less than 1 or 2 seconds. Even for voice over IP now, it's well deployed, people know. And the key parameter which is more important than the outage is the frequency, but nobody talks about it, which is already a good sign that there's not a good analysis there. Then in the industry, a few service providers have already standardized on the 200 milliseconds kinds of objective, because that's the target where the human being no longer notices the outage. And then there is this 50 milliseconds, where, so the 200 milliseconds, I think it's a good target to go to. And then there is the famous 50 milliseconds perceived requirement, and it's basically where humans have a perception that they would be better off if they had it. But actually, nobody is able to prove any gain from it. And so the chart that you have on this slide is actually a proof of this. There's quite a lot of video deployments, and so it's good to talk about video. And in the video context, people say, oh, you absolutely need it 50 milliseconds, otherwise the visual experience is too impacted. And so we did the test with different types of video traffic, either low motion, high motion, SD, or HD quality. And we plot on the x-axis the outage that was created in the lab in terms of packet loss. And on the y-axis, there is a measurement of the visual impairment that can be seen on the screen. And as you can see from the result of this testing, there's almost no difference if the outage is 50 milliseconds or a few hundreds of milliseconds. But in terms of cost for your design and deployment, if you select one or the other, the cost might be huge. The cost difference might be huge. So really spend a lot of time wondering what is your true requirement, and I think it's okay, for example, and I think it's a good target to say a few hundreds of milliseconds in all cases is a good target. If I can maximize with simplicity the number of cases where I have 50 milliseconds, that's great. And that's a bit what we're going to see here. It's not going to give you a guarantee for 50 milliseconds all the time. It's going to give it to you most of the time with very low cost complexity structure. So ITP convergence, the foundation. Why do I describe it as the foundation? Because whether you do MPLS fast reroute, whether you do IPFR, whether you do whatever you do, you always need it. Because it's the one that is going to tell you whether a BGP next hop is available. It will tell you whether PIM source is available. And even for MPLS-TE, when you have a protection and you fall back on a backup path, well, you might have CAC reservation. And there, you want to ensure that your CAC is updated. Or for video streaming, you need to do the CAC upon rerouting. So this is driven also by the IGP convergence. And then, I don't know any MPLS fast reroute deployment that is a full coverage. Most of the time, they only protect links. They rarely protect nodes. And most of the, well, if not always, they only protect a subset of the network. So there are always links or nodes that are not protected. And the fallback is the IGP. And then in case of catastrophic event, your only chance to fall back is the IGP. So whatever you do, you should always care about it and make sure that if you add a project or if you invest into your network, it actually goes in this direction because it's a good direction. You'll benefit from it. So where are we? Very quickly. But it's important to know where the technology is because it helps you assess the gain, the real gain of some additions to your network on top of this. And so this is... I took what I have, so it's a CRS 3.6. It's not a Cisco advertisement, so but it's just to give you an idea of what exists today in terms of technology. So CRS IOX 3.6 in the lab in a triangle topology. It's a local failure. We're going to see in the next slide how you can extrapolate to a complete network, but that's a very good measurement to do. So a local failure, how much time it takes for ISIS to detect the failure, compute shortest path tree, update the RIP, update the FIP, update the line card, and hop all the traffic is rerouted. On the y-axis, you have the time it takes in milliseconds computed with real packets sent by agilent router testers. On the x-axis, you have the number of prefixes in the topology. So there are four priorities of prefixes, critical, high, medium, and low. Critical are typically the IPTV sources. High are the most important BGP next hop. Medium are the other BGP next hop. And then all the infrastructure, which represents the majority of the prefixes, are in the low priority. So if you look, we did the test 100 times. You have the different percentile. Just look at the maximum. It's already very good. You see that for 500 prefixes, the first 500 prefixes, your most important prefixes, it's sub 80 milliseconds. Let's even say that you are a huge network, you have three times more, you have 1,500 prefixes, you are at 140 milliseconds. So that's for local failure. Now, and this doesn't require any tuning. There's no tuning required at all. It's just the default behavior of the system. So let's see how you can use this and now deal with failures on a global network-wide basis. You need to analyze the cost of flooding. So that's the work that we did a few years ago with Pierre and Olivier Bonaventure. We took different worldwide topologies, and we analyzed the failure of each possible link in the worldwide topology. And for each possible link failure, we computed the flows in the traffic matrix which were going through that link. And for each flow in the traffic matrix, we computed which router, the closer to the failure, would reroute onto an alternate path avoiding the failure. And so we and then overall we weighted each distance between the failure and the rerouting router by the amount of traffic on this flow in the traffic matrix. And so what we found out is the typical distance between a failure and a rerouting node. It gives you how much you need to flood through the network. And this is weighted by the traffic, and it is measured both in number of hops, how many hops you need to flood through until you get to your rerouting router, or it's also measured in milliseconds, because for our topologies, we knew the amount of milliseconds between each router based on the speed of light on fiber. The left diagram is the result of the study for the number of hops. And you see it's very rare that you need to flood more than three hops away. The right axis, the right chart, shows that it's extremely rare that you need to flood more than 25 milliseconds away, which is the continent boundary. And we did not do the study to basically find this. We knew it before doing the data. We just wanted to do the study to confirm the intuition. The intuition is that, and that's a big difference between academic world and the real designs and deployment, is that actually often it's much simpler in the reality because it's a human being that designed the network with a lot of redundancy. And so the redundancy means that you do not need to flood far away, and especially when you have a worldwide network, if you have a failure in Asia, you contain it in Asia. If you have a failure in US, you contain it in US. You do not ask a failure in AES to be recovered by a convergence in Europe. Yes, there could be a convergence in Europe, but it would simply switch from a working path to a working path. So based on this study, you can basically, we typically estimate that if you do the local testing and you add a budget of 50 milliseconds for the flooding, that's a fair estimation for the complete network. Why 50 milliseconds? 5 hops multiplied by 5 milliseconds per hop, 25 milliseconds, plus 25 milliseconds of propagation, 50 milliseconds together. If you want to be really, really conservative, compute 100 milliseconds, double it by 2, and it will give you the budget. And so if you do this test and you couple this with plus 50 or plus 100, it gives you a picture for your complete network. And you see that between the two components, we are on the order of a few hundreds of milliseconds, 200, 300 milliseconds for a very large network. What about shortest path 3? This is the measurement for a 900 router ISIS network, all in level 1. We place the CRS in all possible positions in this network, computed how much time it would take to do a full shortest path 3 computation, less than 10 milliseconds, so computing a Dijkstra is extremely quick. It's no longer a problem today. So now, let's focus. Once we have this foundation that gives you a few hundreds of milliseconds in all cases for your network, now let us look what are the low-hanging fruits that you could add on it with the IPFR project. And so the first one is the lossless local maintenance. It's extremely simple. It's simply that to realize that a big share of the events on the network are related to maintenance. And instead of going onto the router and doing a shut of the interface, which basically breaks the hardware information and so create packet loss, and then you tell ISIS to converge, and then you go onto an alternate path. So you disrupt and then you converge. Bad idea. Instead of doing this, you simply do the same operation, but in the context of ISIS, you say you shut the adjacency. So the hardware is still forwarding the packets, while ISIS is computing for an alternate path. The hardware is updated with the new path, and you have zero loss of connectivity. If you want to do really something on top of the foundation, do this. It's typically 30% of the outage, at least, that are related to maintenance. It will give you zero loss instead of a few hundreds of milliseconds of loss. And it requires no software deployment, no new technology, no ITF protocol that you need to understand, test, or so on. Just a little operational practice. In the past, some people have done it by simply costing the metric up. If you want to operate a link, you go to the link and you say you cost it to a very large metric. I don't think it's a good idea, because if you do this, there are two issues. First, you need to do it on the two sides of the link, while if you shut the adjacency, you only do it on one side. And then if you play with the metric, most likely you open yourself for operational mistakes, because when you will put the link back into service, potentially the human being will have forgotten what was the true metric. So shut the adjacency, very simple, no new technology, 30% of the outage on average, and you replace a few hundreds of milliseconds of loss by zero. So that's the ultimum low-hanging fruit. Now, really part of the IPFR project, a very low-hanging fruit, is the Perlink LFA component, the technology. So first, a lemma, that it's worth to know when you look at this project. If I am A, and I want to protect the link to B, I want to protect the red link, AB, and I have, for example, a few hundred routes which I route via B, and I would like to find a backup path for that link, the property tells you that if you find a backup path which is valid for the packets going to B itself, then this backup path is valid for any route you switch through B. So it's intuitive, think about it, but just take it as a statement now. It's very good, because once you have this property, it means that you can only search for a backup path to B itself, and then it will be applicable for any route going through B. So Perlink LFA is simply benefiting from this. I am A, and I check what is the reachability of my direct neighbors. For example, C is a direct neighbor. And I ask myself, what is the path from C to B? If the path from C to B does not go via me, then it means I can trust it. Because if the link AB fails, if I send a packet to C, it will go to B without going through AB. That was an outcome of the fact that the route from C to B doesn't go via AB. And so if you have a neighbor with that property, you call it an LFA. It's a loop-free alternate for the link you want to protect. Very simple. So what are the properties of this? Computing, if your neighbors are a loop-free alternate for a link you'd like to protect, is entirely automated. You don't need to have any human operation in it. It doesn't require any IETF protocol change. All the information is already available in the ISIS classical database. There's no new protocol standardization. It supports incremental deployments. In this example, you can only have the possibility to compute LFA on A, and that's fine. It doesn't ask for any cooperation from C. It doesn't ask any cooperation from B. If you have different vendors, if you have different type of routers, if you have different type of software in your network, you benefit a lot from incremental deployment. As it doesn't require any IETF protocol change, any ISIS change, there is no interoperability testing. So again, much easier for the operator. Then from a testing viewpoint, how much does it achieve? If you do the testing and you, if you fail the link AB in this case and C is an LFA, the loss of connectivity is sub 25 milliseconds. And it is independent of the number of ISIS routes which A route via B. If it's 10, 100, or 1,000, it's always sub 25 milliseconds. It's prefix independent. And it is applicable to MPLS LDP networks. That was a wrong decision made 5 years ago to call this project IPFRR, because then people think it's not for MPLS, but this is entirely usable for LDP networks. And then the best property is to ask yourself, how often do I have this magic LFA? It seems so stupid that it must be very rare. So that's the study we did. We have here 7 European topologies, 5 US topologies, and 1 Japanese topology. And then the last bar is the average. And look at the blue bars. This is the coverage, which means it is the percentage of links in these backbone topologies which can be protected by this simple per-link LFA. And on average, over 7 European networks, 5 US networks, and 1 Japanese network, the average is 78% of the links. For 78% of the link, you have an automated computed per-link LFA, which means that typically the rule of thumb is that for 75% of the events, you have sub 25 milliseconds. For 25% of the events, you fall back on IGP conversions a few hundreds of milliseconds. And that's basically the balance you have to make yourself to say, do I really want to seek for 50 milliseconds all the time? Is it not like a hotspot where I minimize my complexity and then I maximize the benefit? And then what about the POP? So it's a part of the work that we are doing with Pierre now. We'll publish a paper later on building blocks to design for maximizing simple per-link LFA or variation of per-link LFA coverage. But as a starting point for this, if you take these very common POP topologies, and if you call C the metric between the two core routers, and D and U the unidirectional metric from the core router to the aggregation router, or the aggregation router to the PE router, or from the core router to the PE router, in the downstream direction it's D, in the upstream direction it's U. So if you call them like this, the only thing you have to check is C is smaller than D plus U, which in practice is always like this. So if C is smaller, which in practice is very likely to be like this. If C is smaller than D plus U in such topologies, but other as well, but I don't have the time today to go through all of this, then all the links in the POP are protected with per-link LFAs, and there is no macro loop possible in these topologies. So it's extremely interesting to consider this. So it's already a high coverage in the backbone, but I think there is even more potential at the edge, especially for these PE devices, which are typically the older generation, suffering more from the workload, where maybe the IGP convergence is a bit slower because they see the entire network in front of them and they may be of older generation. And so there, they are typically dual ohm, and then it's a no-brainer. If you lose one, you go via the other link, and typically Pauling LFA applies. So that's it for the two first low-hanging fruits. Now, the last section of the talk is about giving you low-hanging fruits, which consist into what question should you ask yourself before going for the next fruits in the IPFR R3, because they might be very high, and the gain for them is pretty small. So it's important to ask yourself these questions, and we ask ourselves these questions. We'll show you the data we got from the topologies we analyzed. So the topic we have not yet discussed too much is microloop. Microloop, there are microloop avoidance techniques that have been defined within the IPFR technology. Should you use them? First question is, how likely is it that you have microloop in your topology? And so we build a tool with Pierre, which uses an algorithm to assess whether a microloop could develop for each possible link failure that would occur in your topology. And so this chart shows the following. On the x-axis, you have the percentage of links in three topologies, three real service provider topologies we analyzed. And then on the y-axis, the proportion of the traffic matrix that experience microloop if this percentage of the links, if these links go down. And so what we see is that for 80% of the links for these three service provider topologies, there's no microloop at all, zero. It's not even possible. And then what you see is that for more or less 10% of the links in the topologies, yes, if they go down, it could create some microloop on a significant part of the traffic matrix. Okay. This study is based on algorithmic study of the topology. It doesn't tell you it will be a microloop. It tells you it is impossible to have a microloop. So when it tells you that a microloop is possible, it means there might be a certain time pattern between the different router events, such that the microloop would form. It doesn't tell you that really it will occur in practice. So we will analyze this later. The next question you should ask yourself is, yeah, even if it occurs, how long will it be? And so there are two answers. The first one is to do it with an analysis of what you would expect. So what is a microloop? It's the natural behavior of an IGP that when it converges, some routers might not update the table for each prefix at the same exact time. And maybe a router is pointing to another router which is pointing at him, and so you have a little microloop that occurs for some fraction of time. As the convergence in terms of current technology is on the order of a few hundreds of milliseconds, as the microloop is a function of the delta convergence between convergences, it's obvious it will be a fraction of a few hundreds of milliseconds. So from an analysis viewpoint, you expect a few tens of milliseconds of microloop if it occurs. So Pierre has been building a simulation environment based on the work we've been doing together, where he has a characterization of the CRS and the IOH software in terms of shortest path free computation, RIP update, FIP update, including the hardware update time. And he computes for each possible node in the topology the number of prefixes that really need to be updated into the hardware. So it's a good model of how the router would work. And this simulation is based on a true service provider topology, a tier one, 900 node in a single level in ISIS. And so what we did during, he failed 500 links in this backbone. And for each possible link failure, the network was simulated, and he computed the amount of microloops that occurred.
And this is plotted on the y-axis. On the x-axis, you have the links. And first thing is that you see 80% of the links, they show no macro loop at all. This is totally expected because from an algorithmic viewpoint, we know that it's proved logically it is impossible for them to occur in 80% of the case in the topology we are looking at, which is either the red or green topology. I no longer remember whether it's A or B. Then let us look at the 20%. We said in 20% of the case, there could be macro loop that would form. And from an analysis viewpoint, we would expect a few tenths of milliseconds, less than 100 of milliseconds. And that's actually what the simulation tells. It's interesting to know that when he did the simulation, he loaded each router with 10 loopbacks. And this is taking into account the micro loop for 9,000 loopback in the network, which is a mistake because it's way more negative than the reality. But it's just telling you that the micro loop are, for most of the time and for most designs, likely insignificant. And so maybe in your case it will be significant, I cannot say, but what I can say, the low-hanging fruit for you is do ask yourself the question, do I care for this? The algorithmic analysis, it's very easy to do. And you'll see what is the proportion of cases where it could occur. Then you do an assessment of if it occurs, how long would it be? And then if you would want to have some simulation done or work, I think Pierre is really welcoming any interaction with service provider to actually continue his work and have case studies. So don't hesitate to contact him or me. If at the end of this analysis you think, a macro loop, it's important for me, I think I need to do something, then the first step that you have to ask yourself is, should I not like care about my IGP? Does it not mean that my IGP is not optimized enough, that it's converging too slow on my topology? Why is it such? First question. If after that step you still think that you need to do something, then here is the mid-hanging fruit. The mid-hanging fruit is an algorithm that you can compute on an offline station. You take a PC or a Linux box. It takes as input your topology. It takes as input the link or node you want to operate on, and it gives you the set of metric increments you need to apply on the link you want to operate on, such that you will be able to put it out of the network for maintenance without any macro loop. So it only applies for maintenance, up and down. It doesn't apply for unplanned outage, so that's why it's not the ultimum, but it still deals with like a good fraction of the outage for micro loops in a very simple manner for an operator. No network change, no new software, no new protocol, no new hardware, no implication on the complexity and reliability of your network. So here is an example of how it works. If I would like to operate the link BC, if I do my lossless local maintenance approach that I said where I shut the adjacency, indeed, locally on B, there would be no loss. But in this specific topology, depending on how B and A converge, there could be a little macro loop forming between B and A for traffic going to C. So if you think, after all the questions I mentioned, and I think it's unlikely, but if you still think at the end that you need to do something, what the tool would provide you with in this case, it would tell you, easy, configure BC with metric 2, wait a little, then configure BC with metric 4, and that's it. You can bring the link down. It will have not created any macro loop anywhere in the network. And indeed, with the first step placing the metric BC to 2, then it pushed A to go via C, and then when you put BC to 4, it pushed B to go via ADC, and at which point no longer any traffic go via BC, and you can work on the link. So he has analyzed, Pierre has analyzed the applicability of the algorithm on real topologies, and the outcome is that for most of the links, it only requires 2 or 3 metric changes. And again, the KISS principle here will tell you, okay, if you really want to do something, Just do it for the case where it's simple, two or three metrics. And then the tail of the curve, forget about it. Just shut the adjacency, do a local lossless maintenance. You might have a microloop for a few tens of milliseconds. Do you really care? Do you want to really increase your complexity in your network for this? So we reached the conclusion. What we try to do through the talk is to highlight that requirements are extremely important. They are the source of often unneeded complexity. Really spend a lot of time there. And I think it's fine to define a requirement to say, in terms of routing outage, a few hundreds of milliseconds is what people care. I should do it all the time. And in most of the time, I should try to do 50 milliseconds. Then you can kind of like trade off political, perceptual requirements with a network design that will simplify, that will be simplified, and hence I think in the end much more robust, much more reliable, which the end customers will actually prefer. Remember the quote from Dijkstra: simplicity is prerequisite for reliability. Do not look at the gains without considering the implied complexity. We've seen that the IGP convergence is the always needed foundation. It's on the order of a few hundreds of milliseconds. Then there are three low-hanging fruits to consider. Lossless local maintenance. You shut the ISIS adjacency before operating a link. Zero loss. Perlink LFA. Automated. No new ITF thing. Incremental deployment. No interoperability testing. Sub 25 milliseconds, prefix independence, coverage for 13 real service provider topologies, 78%, coverage in the POP. I think most of the POP structures are very nice for Perlink LFA. See, we've seen the slide. In terms of microloop, ask yourself the question, how important is it? If you really think something is important, first, optimize your IGP. Second, consider the offline tool. It has no impact on your network. And then in the end, no religion. IPFR was a bad term. It's equally applicable to an MPLS network. And for example, a combination that might make sense, if you already have a full mesh in the backbone, is to use Perlink LFA in the POP to simplify your full mesh such that it doesn't go too close to the edge. And then finally, use tools. We've built a few tools to help you do these analyses. Don't hesitate to contact us for this. Many thanks for the time to talk, and many thanks for your questions here or after. Don't hesitate.
Many thanks, Clarence. We can take one question before we move on. Franz, if you... No immediate questions? Okay. Thank you very much for coming.
Hi, my name is Franz. I'm from the Information Services Department at the RIPNCC. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about MyASN and how we improved it in the last couple of months. So first of all, if you don't know MyASN, ask yourself two questions. Do you know when your prefix gets hijacked? And do you know when your transit provider suddenly changes? If you don't, soon you will. And you will hopefully be a bit of a happier engineer then. What is MyASN? Well, it's the alarm system of the routing information service. The routing information services has 15 RSCs all over the world, and they collect BGP updates from 620 peers, more than 620 peers actually. And users get notified when someone else announces their prefix or someone unexpectedly gives transit to them. And this can be done by either syslog or email. So this is already really nice, and the system works, and I think many of you use it already. But just recently, we improved it a lot, and that's what I'd like to show you. Since we have many information services at the RIPE NCC, such as TTM or DNSMON, we wanted a unified alarms solution for all of our things. So we invented this very nice three-stage system. It consists of an input. In this case, it would be the routing information service. In other cases, it could be DNSMON or TTM. Then there is a filter stage where you can define how you want to react on the data that comes in. And an output stage where you can say, OK, I want to be alarmed via email or via syslog. And the nice thing about this is all plugin based, so we can easily extend it. I want to give you a quick example here. Well, as I said, we have these three stages, input, filter, and output. And in this example, we are going to look at RIS as an input. And the RIS input gives BGP updates and timestamps to the system. Then we can put a filter in place. We want to monitor that my prefix only originates from AS3333. And we connect it to the BGP update of the RIS input. And I want to be informed via email whenever something bad happens. Also, we don't have that in the system yet, but just to show you how flexible it is and how much further we can extend it, in the future we could also have SMS. And we simply connect that also to that filter, and we get nice SMS notifications. However, some of you only work from 9 to 5 and might not want to be disturbed at night by this system, and so we can put in another filter, 9 to 5. A filter connected to time and to the SMS output plugin, and you will only be informed between 9 and 5. So now you can already see how flexible that system is and how easily we can extend that and make it work with other systems. So what does it bring you? Well, it is available today. I know some of you already have moved their accounts to the new system. We sent out an announcement 2 weeks ago, yes? It will be the unified alarm system for all information services. At the moment, it supports RIS and DNSMON. TTM will follow in the future. We have full IPv6 support here, very proud of that. Possibility for new notifications, we're thinking about SMS or Jabber. And a very nice thing that will make you very happy, because I know MySN hasn't always been the fastest to inform you about things. Now we have a much faster response time, and we do have about 5 minutes latency between something happening and you getting informed about it. It's available at ripe.net/is/alarms, and if you have an old account and want to migrate it to the new system, you can go to this URL. Quick peek at the user interface. This is the overview for your alarms. In the future, you might also have TTM alarms in there or DNSMON alarms. You can easily activate, edit, or view these alarms. This is the interface for adding a new alarm. And this would be the overview of the alarm, where you get nicely aggregated messages so that you also don't get spammed by the system, of course. But if you want to go into more detail and have a look at all the single messages that have been generated, you can see that in there. All right, quick involvement, how you can get in touch with us. If you want to know anything about this or give us feedback, email to isops@ripe.net. You can email me directly also, franz@ripe.net. I would also have a few small questions for you. Once you've used that, how do you like the new interface? What kind of notifications would you want? Somebody mentioned SNMP already. Jabber would be maybe something nice. Do you have any other ideas? And of course, any other feedback is welcome as well. And I'm also doing a demo stand tomorrow after the test traffic working group. A few people visited me there already yesterday. I'm happy to welcome you there and show you a little bit more about this and our other information services. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you, Franz. Any questions for Franz regarding MSN? Okay, Peter.
Peter Janssen, your ID, not exactly about my ASN, but the other thing you just mentioned in talking is in the future DNSMON alarms. When will this be coming?
It is already
okay.
Active. It works. For our DNS-1 subscribers, it is available at the very same interface as the MyASM.
Yeah. Okay, this is great stuff, as you know, that I was rather pushing for this. Another thing you mentioned, 5 minutes update, that's still not really live. Will there ever
yes.
be a live thing?
We hope so. With the system, we certainly have the possibility to make this even better mm-hmm. and even more real-time. We are currently Eric especially is working very hard on getting our new database servers and our new database scheme up for the RIS, and that will certainly improve everything. Right now, the problem is a little bit we have a very large MySQL database that we are at the moment trying to make new, and then
okay.
the latency will be much smaller. We hope to get to real time also.
Okay. Last thing, as a suggestion, as an alternative notification mechanism instead of email, can I propose Jabber as the one that you would be working on the first thing, because that's something that our monitoring systems can then pick up in live real time, I would say.
Right.
I'm not that interested in SMS. I mean, that we can do ourselves once we get a live notification over any other synchronous communication channel.
All right. Okay.
Thanks
for that feedback.
Thank you. Any other questions? No? Then thank you again very much for presenting.
Thank you.
Yes, so clear. This was the last agenda item. We have one more, which is called AOP. I don't know if anyone has any other business that you would like to bring up. Okay, otherwise we are done. At 3:30, don't forget, we start going out for the ripe dinner activity. It is quite a logistical endeavor involving 55 all four-wheel drive vehicles. People are expected to board on packets of 6, which is what fits in each of them. So don't get nervous. Everyone will get in there. It may take a little while for the 55 vehicles to go and load. Take it easy and enjoy yourselves. Don't forget to take your camera. No, the pickup is in the usual exit over there. We go into the vehicles, and as soon as they are full with 6 persons each, they move. Okay? And if you are the kind of people like me who feels cold when temperature goes down, it does tend to get a little bit chilly in the desert when the sun goes down. So don't forget to take a jacket with you. Thank you. Bye.